We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about Afghanistan, and our guest is Peter Thompson. He is ambassador in residence at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, where he teaches courses in American foreign policy and Eurasia. In the late 80s and early 1990s, he served as a special envoy to the Afghan resistance. Now, over time, he's met with many of the key figures in the country's conflicts over the past two decades. And this morning, we'll be talking about the way that Afghanistan has been shaped by the many foreign powers who have tried to control the country. We'll also consider the role that Pakistan has played in the politics of its neighbor and talk about the prospects for Afghanistan as the United States prepares to leave. All of this and more can be found in a new book that Peter Thompson has authored. The title of his book is The Wars of Afghanistan, Messianic Terrorism, Tribal Conflicts, and the Failures of Great Powers. It is recently published by Public Affairs. You can find it in the bookstore. If you go looking for the book, by the way, his last name is spelled T-O-M-S-E-N. Let me tell you a little bit more about him. He has had a long career in the U.S. Foreign Service. He served as the American ambassador to Armenia from 1995 until 1998. Then he served as President George W. Bush's special envoy on Afghanistan with the rank of ambassador. That was in the late 80s and early 90s. He's also had a number of other posts. He was Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs in the Department of State, and he's also served in a number of places in the State Department. He served in Moscow, in Thailand, in India, in China. He also served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal. This was in the early to mid-1960s. And he's joining us this morning by phone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. Toll free, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. And Ambassador Thompson, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
I think the value of the book is it gives some historical context, I think, for trying to understand where we are now in Afghanistan. But I thought that it would be the place to begin with where we are now. The president has said that he believes that the United States has, for the most part, accomplished what it needed to in Afghanistan and has announced that troops would be withdrawn, although he also said that we should expect there should be some American troops in the country, perhaps until 2014. But the question is, you know, what were the goals? And if you say, well, the goal was to remove the Taliban from power, well, I guess that's been accomplished. If the goal was to have a stable government, there's some question about whether that's been accomplished. Where do you think we stand now with Afghanistan? And have we, in fact, accomplished our goals?
Well, not yet. But we, as you know so well, and your audience does too, that we have many problems at home now, and they demand attention, and we need resources here and I think around the world, including in Afghanistan. We're going to begin to have to scale back to handle these issues at home. The problems, though, still remain in this region, and we have to, when we discuss Afghanistan, also discuss Pakistan. The raid on bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad on May 1 really took the veil off Pakistan's double game in Afghanistan. As you know, Pakistan's generals had for years said that Osama bin Laden was not in Pakistan, but in fact, they were protecting him in Abbottabad and insisting that he was not in their country. Now, writ large, this goes far beyond Osama bin Laden. There is an entire infrastructure of sanctuaries for the Islamic radicals inside Pakistan, not inside Afghanistan. And any major or captain in the U.S. Army who served along the border with Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the Illinois National Guard has been active in Afghanistan and has been out there several times, will tell you that the jihadi highway from these sanctuaries in Pakistan is the reason the war is continuing inside Afghanistan. The fires in Pakistan, the smoke comes into Afghanistan, and as long as that as long as this continues, I think war will continue to tear Afghanistan. The surge was a good move, but it could not reach its full potential, certainly, because of these sanctuaries. We could send 500,000 troops to Afghanistan, and it would not put out the flames in Pakistan. So the raid in Abbottabad has exposed Pakistan's decades-long double game, and we have to get tougher with Pakistan if we're going to resolve the problem in Afghanistan. And also, if I could continue, mm-hmm. we have to remember that in these training sanctuaries where the Taliban are equipped and sent into Afghanistan, not to mention the Haqqani network and the and also the Hekmatyar network along the frontier, in those same sanctuaries, terrorists are being trained to go abroad, to hit the United States, like Faisal Shahzad. Last year, he tried to bomb Times Square. He was trained in North Waziristan. And others bombing subways in Spain or in London and striking Asian countries, and bombs are going off in Saudi Arabia, too. All of this violence, Islamist violence emanating from the region, comes not from Afghanistan, but comes from Pakistan. And the violence inside Afghanistan, and most suicide bombers come from Pakistan, is also emanating from Pakistan.
I wonder if you could talk about one point in history in particular. And it seems that it's one of those points where things could have gone one way or could have gone another way. And I'm thinking of the point at which the Afghan resistance had managed to drive the Soviets out. The Soviets had been there for 10 years, from 1979 to 1989. And then it seemed that we came to a point where, though the Afghan fighters that had managed to defeat the Soviets started to fight one another, and eventually we end up with the Taliban. And here again, I'm sure that we'll be talking about the role of Pakistan. But I think that the question that I'm interested in is what happened at that point that rather than going into a period of rebuilding, that we went from the insurgency that defeated the Soviets essentially to civil war?
Yes, that's really, really a good question. Because that was a pivotal moment when things could have gone in the right direction. Because if the Afghans, it's a tribal culture and society, that's explained in the book at some length. And they have their problems, but in their history, they have a Pashtunwali tradition. It's called this institution of the Jirga, where if everybody has a seat at the table, all the tribal groups, religious and ethnic groups, they work things out. And that was what we were hoping for in the Reagan administration and in the Bush 41 administration when the Soviets pulled out, that there would be an act of self-determination in Afghanistan to finally let the Afghans, after losing over 1 million dead and 5 million fled abroad at the time, that they would be able to select their own leaders and choose their own way forward. They could also use this Loya Jirga institution, which is the national Jirga, which they've used from time to time in their history during times of crisis. But that was not to be. The Pakistani military dictator Zia-ul-Haq and later generals pivoted into Afghanistan covertly through the Pakistani ISI, that's the Pakistani military intelligence, took the lead, and attempted to implant in Kabul a radical Islamic government led by a radical firebrand named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. So that ignited the civil war, because most Afghans are moderate, nationalist, and they resisted. But Pakistan was able to give favorable treatment, arms, and ammunition to the radicals. So that set off the civil war. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar never was able to get to Kabul, despite shelling it and causing 40,000 deaths. During this period, there was little interest in the United States in Afghanistan. In fact, we outsourced our policy to Pakistan, which was a big blunder. Later, the ISI chose the Taliban and put them together and used them to attack and eventually capture Kabul. So this was not exactly a civil war as in the American sense of the term in the 1860s when you had different sections of the country fighting each other. This was more like the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s when you had foreign powers, you know, the fascists, the Germans, the Italians, and the British, and the Americans, the democratic powers, in Spain attempting to help various factions which were fighting each other. So Pakistan and Iran got involved inside Afghanistan in the Civil War period. And if they had not done that, if the Afghans, as we had hoped, would have been allowed to, without outside interference, choose their own way and their own leaders, we could have had stability in Afghanistan, but that opportunity was missed.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as Pakistan was concerned, was their chief motivation simply having a regime next door in the neighboring country that they could control?
Yes. That is their cardinal problem, because and that was their objective. But no country can control Afghanistan. I mean, history has shown that time and time again, the British, the Soviets, and nor can the Pakistanis. Because the Afghans will resist any outside power attempting to control them. But the Pakistani policy drove the country into internal turmoil and this continuing cycle of wars. That's sort of the title of the book, The Wars of Afghanistan. And to get out of this cycle, all outside powers have to step back and exercise mutual restraint and allow the Afghans to choose their own path ahead. Most of them would like to go back to what many of them call the era of tranquility, which existed before the communist coup in 1978 and the Soviet invasion in 79, when this was a tribal country following tribal politics, and it worked in its own way. But we are now in a very difficult situation. We have to pull out our troops, our combat troops. And many Afghans know that they have to stand on their own two feet now. It's been 9 years. They do want us to leave, not precipitously. They want us to leave in a stabilizing way, not a destabilizing way. They want us to continue to help them. And in other words, they want us to stay as well as to go, and to provide economic assistance to help train their military to stand up to these waves of invasions coming in from Pakistan. And they also want the United States and the coalition it leads to act as a hedge against Pakistan.
Well, as you noted, I think a lot of people felt that it was a great mistake for the United States to essentially turn away from Afghanistan at the point where the Soviets left. So the United States, they were supplying support to the freedom fighters who were fighting the Soviets. This was one of these third world proxy wars. It was the Cold War. So the Soviets were defeated. The United States said, well, okay, that's good. We're done with that. And then they went on to something else, and that made it possible for the Taliban to come to power with the support of Pakistan. So then we went back. We went back in 2001. Now one can argue about whether or not the job has been completed, but is there a risk that we will make the same mistake we made before, and that is we'll say, well, we need to go on to other things, that the Afghans have to solve their own problems, and that, you know, how do we walk that line between having all these troops there and being heavily involved and then essentially saying to the Afghans, well, good luck and see you later?
Right. That again, the answer to that is to you can't have an effective policy, especially a long-term policy, which is missing now. I was kind of disappointed in President Obama's speech when he announced the drawdown, which I supported, and we do need to take out significant numbers of troops and continue steadily to take out all of our combat troops. On the other hand, he had the opportunity, but he missed it, to lay out a long-term policy to accomplish our long-term goals, which is stabilization and to snuff out the Islamic extremism emanating from that region against us. Our national security, our homeland, as well as the homelands of our allies and friends. So the problem of walking away is that it's like pulling a blind over your eyes, and you say, well, I'm finished here, and I'm gone. But that is a huge mistake. What happened in the 90s was that the Pakistani military intelligence, whom we outsourced our policy to, they were able to get the Taliban into Kabul and conquer most of the country. But Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda followed quickly behind, and all of the hijackers that hit us on 9/11 came from Osama bin Laden's trading camps inside Afghanistan. When we went back to Afghanistan after 9/11 and defeated the Taliban and al-Qaeda, drove them back into Pakistan, they just went back to their old sanctuaries, which are today still doing, under ISI aegis, churning out thousands of jihadis to attack into Afghanistan. And also this terrorist impulse around the world continues. Our mistake also is believing that Pakistan was still a Cold War ally, as they were at one time. They assisted us in building this containment structure around the Soviet Union. But after Zia-ul-Huq's time, or during and after Zia-ul-Huq's time, the Pakistani military intelligence has attempted to Islamicize the, as I mentioned, Pakistan, but also to champion the extremists in the Mujahideen, who have been allied with foreign terrorists as well. When we drove the Taliban back into Afghanistan, along with al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, they were protected inside Pakistan. Musharraf announced that he was allied with the United States in the war on terror, but covertly, he and ISI revamped the Taliban, re-equipped them, rearmed them, and sent them back into Afghanistan. The major Taliban offensives began in 2005. We responded by sending more troops to stop them, and those offensives have continued until today, and that's why the surge has not worked as well as it should have. In the meantime, the Bush administration declared that Musharraf and Pakistan were major non-NATO allies of the United States and did not condition our assistance. Now that the veil has come off what is actually the case in Pakistan's policy, as revealed at Abbottabad, we're getting more realistic, and we've begun to condition our military and economic aid, which we should have been doing for 10 years. But we should also take some other steps, geostrategic steps and bilateral steps, which will send a message to Pakistan that you have to close down these sanctuaries, close down the supply lines into Afghanistan, and cooperate more closely with us in the war against global terrorism.
Our guest, let me reintroduce our guest, is Peter Thompson. He is ambassador in residence at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, where he teaches courses on American foreign policy and Eurasia. He served as President George W. Bush's special envoy on Afghanistan with the rank of ambassador. This was in the late 80s and early 90s, and had things gone differently after the Soviets left, he would have been the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He has many years of experience in the U.S. Foreign Service and Department of State, serving in a number of places, Moscow, Thailand, India, China. And he is the author of a new book that looks at the history of Afghanistan. The title is The Wars of Afghanistan. It's published by Public Affairs. And we do have several callers to talk with. Again, people can help us by being brief and being on target with questions, but questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. First caller is in Rensselaer, Indiana. Our line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning, Ambassador Mike.
Morning.
Many people say that we abandoned Afghanistan, and now it looks like we might be in the process of abandoning it again. Is it really fair to say that when we left earlier that it was an abandonment, or had our objectives for the most part been achieved and we left because we had achieved our objectives? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Mike, there were four objectives that were laid out in formal policy statements by both Reagan administrations and the George H.W. Bush administration. One was the withdrawal of Soviet forces, you know, the defeat of the Soviet army in Afghanistan, and that was accomplished. But the three others involved First, a act of self-determination by the Afghan people to choose their own way and in a democratic matter, either by elections or loya jirga. The return of the 5 million refugees, a good part of the country's population, in dignity and honor. And finally, U.S. assistance, along with others, in reconstructing the country. So we just left Afghanistan by 1992 in terms of the other three objectives, sort of gave up on them and turned Afghanistan virtually over to Pakistan, whose policy rhetorically was the same as ours, those four goals, but covertly it was the opposite of ours, which was to install Hekmatyar and later the Taliban, who were both very anti-American, in power in Kabul, and to carry on not only jihad in Afghanistan, but also in the Central Asian republics and other parts of the world, the Middle East. And the corollary of all of this from this ideology, the jihadi ideology, was that these same movements, the same policy, was generating global terrorism, Islamic terrorism, out of these camps. And that will only grow in the months and years ahead if we leave again, as before, and not continue to be engaged. That, as I said earlier, that doesn't mean more combat troops. We're doing the right thing in pulling out combat troops. And I was against sending so many combat troops over the last decade. We should have proceeded in a different way and stood up an Afghan army soon after we expelled the Taliban and al-Qaeda from Afghanistan. Instead, we concentrated on Iraq, and we turned everything over to warlords who were open to bids from all sides. And then the Taliban were able to make a comeback without an Afghan army blocking the way. So we've made a number of mistakes, but we still have a chance to salvage success in Afghanistan. I talk about that in the last chapter of the book, Chapter 25. And we should, we're a great country, and we don't walk away from problems, especially when they affect our national interests. So we should stay engaged with both Pakistan and Afghanistan. And as I mentioned earlier, we need to focus especially on Pakistan to get Pakistan to make a fundamental change in its policy.
You know, Pakistan has certainly been very important to the United States carrying out its policies in the region going back some time, at least as far back to the point when General Zia was in power, because the Pakistans aided the United States in supporting the Afghan freedom fighters. They were our link to the Mujahideen, and then afterwards, as you say, we thought they could look after our interests in Afghanistan, and they were pretty much looking after their own interests. Then they continued to be very important as we went back in 2001. So it seemed like that all along that the Pakistanis were in a position to saying to us, well, you need us more than we need you. And it doesn't really seem the United States has much in the way of leverage when it comes to trying to influence Pakistan.
Well, actually, David, I agree with that assessment that we were together up until the Soviet departure. But they already had a hidden agenda in Zia's vision for Afghanistan and this Islamization drive, which, incidentally, the Pakistani army uses this against the secular democratic parties in Afghanistan. No government has been able to serve out its full term. It's always been overthrown by the military in the last 20 years. As long as they are able to follow this policy of alliance with radical Islamic factions, they can keep the secular parties out of power in Pakistan. Now, the army's been discredited by the Abbottabad raid and the unveiling of what their policy actually is, this duplicitous policy of playing firemen and arsonists in Afghanistan around the world. So there's going to be some changes in Pakistan's internal policies, internal situation, hopefully for the good. On leverage, we have a lot of leverage, and they don't have very much. We should attempt to maintain good relations with Pakistan. We have had good relations with Pakistan in the past, but after Abbottabad, we should no longer publicly and privately be prepared to tolerate what they are doing from Pakistan into Afghanistan and globally. We have a lot of leverage strategically because there's no Muslim government in the world, including Saudi Arabia, that supports the emanating of violence, Islamist violence coming from Pakistan. Saudi Arabia has been hit by Al-Qaeda, too. Al-Qaeda, one of its stated purposes is to overthrow the monarchy. And the monarchy has begun normalizing relations with India, which is something that is not in Pakistan's interest. King Abdullah went to India 2 years ago. Manmohan Singh, the Indian Prime Minister, visited Saudi Arabia last year, and they signed an extradition treaty, which is obviously aimed at anti-terrorism motives. China wants to see a stable Afghanistan, not a return of the wild-eyed Sunni fanatics from Pakistan into Afghanistan, threatening their Western Muslim populations inside China. China has just purchased a $3 billion copper mine in Afghanistan, and there's considerable mineral resources in Afghanistan, which China wants access to, not to mention trade routes through a stable Afghanistan into Europe and South Asia. So it's not in China's interest. It's certainly not in Russian interest and the interest of the Central Asian republics to see the Taliban return, nor in Iran's interest. So we have a lot of leverage indirectly to Iran, but directly with these other greater powers in the region and through the UN Security Council. We have the ability to put more pressure on Pakistan to change policy. We took the first step in conditioning our assistance. It's obscene that this has continued so long without such strings attached, given what they have been doing in Afghanistan. There's other steps we could take, including indicating privately to Pakistan that we are considering putting them on the terrorist list that is kept by the State Department. We have economic steps we can take and further steps. So we are not without leverage. They don't have much leverage. They can appeal to China or Iran, but in my judgment, that won't work. The only step they can take is to ramp up the insurgency further inside Afghanistan through the jihadi network. That's a possibility, but that should only bring stronger steps from us to put pressure on them to abandon that policy. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Peter Thompson. He is an ambassador in residence at University of Nebraska at Omaha, author of a new book on Afghanistan. We'll take some calls and talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Every man at some point in his life is going to lose a battle. He's going to fight and he's going to lose. But what makes him a man is that in the midst of that battle, he does not lose himself.
On the next Fresh Air, we say goodbye to the critically acclaimed TV series Friday Night Lights and feature interviews with two of its stars. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon and have 10 different topics every week. I'll mention just quickly, on Monday, we'll do our regular monthly show on home maintenance. You have a problem, we'll get you some advice. Scott Spies, and we'll be here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. Then in the second hour, we will talk about the life of Frederick Law Olmsted, a man who is known as the designer of Central Park in New York. But there's much more to him and his life than that. We'll talk about it with Justin Martin. He's a writer, biographer, has written a new book about Olmsted. The title of the book is Genius of Place. You can find out what we'll be doing for the rest of next week and listen to past programs you might have missed by going to our website. It is will.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Peter Thompson. He teaches courses in American foreign policy and Eurasia at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He has served as the American ambassador to Armenia. He was President George W. Bush's, this is the first President Bush, his special envoy on Afghanistan with the rank of ambassador from 1989 until 1992. He's also done other work in the State Department. He was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs in the State Department, also served in Moscow, Thailand, India, China, and is author of a new book that's titled The Wars of Afghanistan. It is published by Public Affairs. We have some other callers here we'll bring into the conversation and talk next with someone in Thomasboro, line one.
Yeah, hello. Good morning. Ambassador, I wonder if you could expand and explain how the Clinton, Bush, and now Obama administration support for Unocal Corporation's objectives in Afghanistan and Pakistan are driving both our diplomatic and military operations within that region.
That was Unocal was a pipeline effort to build a pipeline from Turkmenistan through western and southern Afghanistan, Kandahar area included, down into Pakistan in the 1990s. There were individuals in the private sector that supported this and were retainers for Unocal to pursue this objective. And there was also indirect support from the State Department in principle to support this, although there was no money promised from the U.S. government. That project was never a possibility because the Taliban were then in Afghanistan. And as I mentioned earlier, war will continue to roll on in Afghanistan as long as the Taliban are a factor there, because they are more or less the cat's paw. They were created by ISI, and they're run by ISI, the Pakistani military intelligence. So most Afghans would resist it, and Russia and other countries, India, would arm the anti-Taliban resistance. So in the 1990s, when Unocal began its efforts, there was never any chance to succeed. In 1998, in August, Osama bin Laden hit our two embassies in Africa, in Tanzania and Kenya, and we retaliated by firing cruise missiles at Osama bin Laden's training camps in Afghanistan. Unocal then pulled completely out of Afghanistan and has not returned since then.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go on to another caller here. This is Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Yes, it's very good to hear a really knowledgeable person discussing Afghanistan. I would like to ask you, though, most of us here in this country focus on Afghanistan and the Taliban, but how much do the Pakistani military perhaps see it somewhat differently? Is perhaps the focus of their concern on the other side, India and more particularly Kashmir? And do they hope to use the Taliban both against India and in Kashmir in the future?
Yes. And there has been a tradition of the Pakistani military using groups like the Taliban in wars against India. Like, for instance, in 1947 and 1965 and 1971, the army armed these militant groups, especially in the border areas, in the tribal agencies in Pakistan, and even elsewhere. In 1971, two brigades, Islamist brigades, the Al-Sadr and Al-Badr brigades, were organized by ISI and the Pakistani religious parties. And these jihadis were trained and sent to Bangladesh and fought with the Pakistani army. And these groups also in 47 and 65 and 71 went into Kashmir because it's near the tribal agencies. And by proxy forces, Islamist proxy forces like this, the Pakistani military was able to exercise plausible denial. In other words, covertly they armed and trained them and sent them into these areas, but they denied that they had any connection with them. Now, that began in 1975 in Afghanistan for a few months when Pakistan sent armed Afghan students into Afghanistan. But after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, that became big business, and we supported it because we wanted also to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan, that these Afghan forces were trained and armed inside Pakistan and sent into Afghanistan to fight the Soviet invaders. So this is a tradition of proxy war that has been underway now for several decades, and on top, sort of the overlay is that it's not done as an official policy of the Pakistani government. They exercise plausible denial, stating that they're not our troops. There's an interesting excerpt in Shultz's memoirs. George Shultz was the Secretary of State for Ronald Reagan. in which he recounts a conversation between President Reagan and Zeal Huck. And the Geneva Accords had just been signed, and the president said, well, what are you going to do? Because in practice, you'll be violating the agreement. And Zeal Huck answered, as written in the memoirs of George Shultz, that doesn't matter. We've been lying for years that Muslims have a right to lie to non-Muslims in a good cause. And I think today, and in the last 10 years after 9/11, I think that's basically what Pakistan's been doing to us.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We've talked quite a lot in our conversation about the involvement of Pakistan in Afghanistan. And there's another country here that you deal with in the book, and I think we should talk about, hasn't gotten very much attention. At least I don't really see it written very much about in what I read about Afghanistan, and that's Saudi Arabia.
Right.
In what way has the Saudi regime been involved in Afghanistan?
As with everything else involving Afghanistan, it's a very complicated answer. I devote two chapters to Saudi Arabia in the book because, as you say, it's an essential part of explaining the wars of Afghanistan, including today. When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, the Saudi monarchy was reeling with an uprising in the Grand Mosque, the most holy sanctuary in Islam, in Mecca, where radical Wahhabis, this is the Islamic version, Wahhabism, which is practiced, it's a very, very rigid version of Islam in Saudi Arabia. It's got a very anti-Shia, anti-moderate direction to it. So, and there's a huge clerical establishment in Saudi Arabia, which is an Islamic state. And if the religious establishment decides that the monarchy is un-Islamic or is even anti-Islamic, that would be extremely dangerous to the monarchy, which is the custodian of Islam inside Saudi Arabia. So the Saudi royal family has to be very observant of the attitudes of the clerical establishment, especially the clerical leadership. And this uprising in the Grand Mosque, which took place against the Saudi royal family, in which the leaders declared them infidels and no longer following the path of Islam, took place in 1979. They were reeling from this shock, and then the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in basically the same month as this uprising. So the leadership then went full square behind supporting this Wahhabi wind and the Muslim extremism to flow into Pakistan, where the Mujahideen was being trained and sent into Afghanistan. And this had a powerful influence on the ideology, the Islamic ideology, and also the ideology of the Mujahideen movement during this period. It also coincided with Zeal Huck's effort to Islamicize the Afghan resistance against the mainstream of Afghan culture and religion. But nonetheless, for internal political reasons, the Saudi royal family and the promoted the export of this ideology and thousands of jihadis, not only from Saudi Arabia, but from other countries. And the petrodollars not only backed that, but the petrodollars to this day play a major role in sustaining the Islamist infrastructure along the border with Afghanistan. On the other hand, when Osama bin Laden turned against Saudi Arabia in the late 1990s, and the Saudi monarchy began to combat the al-Qaeda and ultra-radical elements inside the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, there was a break with this extremist ideology on the part of the royal family, and particularly King Abdullah has taken the lead to cooperate closely with us and with other countries that are suffering or victims of this violence emanating from Pakistan. to wipe it out. Their relations with Pakistan, the Saudi relations with Pakistan, have frayed because of this difference.
Mm. Well, there have been times in Afghan history when a strong leader has managed to get people to line up behind him, and we see periods of relative stability and unity. Having said that, though, it's also true that there are rivalries between groups in this country, rivalries of very long standing, and there is really no history of a strong central government in Afghanistan ever. So that makes one wonder, well, in the future, what sort of potential there is actually for a strong central government, given that it's really never happened before.
Yes, I think it's you're right, David. I think it's unrealistic to think that the central government has ever or in the foreseeable future will ever directly rule at the local level. The book explains some length, and the leader of the opposition in Britain recently wrote an article about this, and it's so true, that the stability in Afghanistan in this unique country has been held by an equilibrium between the center and the regions, where most Afghans live, about 80%. And they live in about 30,000 rural communities, some less than 100 people, in these tribal and ethnic clan groups. And before the horrors started in 1978, this balance between the center and the region worked very well. There were democratic institutions in the 1960s and into up to 1973 in Afghanistan, and the tribal khans in the regions sat there and discussed laws, and the monarchy itself at that time was tribal, and the center would help the tribes resolve disputes among themselves, but the balance was kept because the center never tried to dominate the regions. If they attempted to dominate the regions would rise up against the center. On their part, these communities, tribal communities in the regions, needed assistance. They wanted schools, they wanted roads, and they wanted the central government to help them get those. So they got the assistance from the center to modernize, to develop these institutions, and they, in turn, the center got the modernization process. This developed over about a 30-year period, actually some would say 50-year period, up to the communist coup, these trends. And Afghanistan, indeed, as people who visited the country before 1978 will attest, was really moving in the right direction, was one of the more successful stories in the Third World. But when Soviet invasion occurred, everything went backwards and was shattered. And today, the country still is in a semi-ruined state. They've made some progress, but there's so many problems, including corruption, that it's a difficult situation. And the center really does not rule the regions.
We have about 5 minutes here. We have another caller, so let's talk with him here in Urbana, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
First, I'd like to thank the ambassador for his comments recently. But I would like to say quickly that never or ever in Afghanistan is a very long time. And to say that there was never a strong central government in Afghanistan ignores the fact that Afghanistan was the birthplace of the Mughal Empire, which reigned over both Iran, Afghanistan, and most of India for about 300 years, with one of the most brilliant civilizations the world has ever seen. Prior to that, in antiquity, which is going back a bit, but even into the Middle Ages, Herat, Merv, and I believe at times Mashhad ruled over an area that was reasonably stable and included most of Afghanistan, as well as eastern modern Iran and most of a good share of Central Asia. So there is a tradition when they're not beset upon by outsiders such as the Russians and the English for a stable government in Afghanistan. Thank you.
Well, all right. Well, I would certainly defer to greater expertise than mine. Maybe I should be careful about making sweeping statements. I think, though, that the caller certainly makes a very important point, and that is that so much of the, maybe we'll say, the troubles of the country do indeed have to do with coping with foreign invasion. And the two big ones, I suppose, were the ones that the caller mentioned, with the British and the Russians. And then, you know, one can say that perhaps that the Pakistanis and the United States and the Saudis and Iran and maybe have not helped because they have their own agendas for the region too.
Yes, the Mughal Empire was an Indian Mughal Empire. It wasn't based in Kabul, although Babur, the founder of it, was born there and moved into India. But it operated as the Indian Mughal Empire, and Herat is in Afghanistan, far western Afghanistan. Mashhad and the other city that the caller mentioned are in Iran. But David, you're absolutely right that the Afghans still have not, if we go back to even to the Reagan administration, have not had the opportunity to exercise their act of self-determination, that the country is still buffeted by externally fueled wars. And until we establish a buffer zone type concept, neutral Afghanistan, and mutual restraint by the outside powers to allow them to do that, I think the war will continue in Afghanistan. Mm.
Just, I don't know how useful it is to fix on particular personalities, but since I know that you are acquainted with President Karzai, and in fact, I do believe you were traveling with him at one point when attempt was made on his life.
So yeah, there was an ambush on his convoy. I was in the car in front of him.
Yeah.
And a guard started shooting into his car.
So I think questions certainly have been raised about his leadership. Now, now people will understand that this is a very difficult thing that we're talking about, being leader of a country like this with all its various factions and divisions. But having said all that, what might you say about the effectiveness of President Karzai?
I think that he's been a good tribal politician, good at balancing tribes, but he hasn't governed well. He hasn't managed a multi-tiered situation. Granted, there's tremendous pressure on him. There's a war underway. There's 49 troop contributing countries he has to deal with. There's tremendous economic problems and sort of overwhelm any leader. But the corruption that has ensued in Afghanistan is, aside from the sanctuaries that exist for the Taliban and the extremists in Pakistan, is the major reason why things aren't going well in Afghanistan, in my judgment, the corruption. So there's elections now, new national elections, which will take place in Afghanistan in 2014. A new leadership will come to the fore, and they will have their own way. I think you'll get a stronger leader like that last caller was referring to. There have been strong leaders in Afghan history, although they haven't dominated the regions. And the United States and other countries will have an opportunity to work with a new leader who hopefully will have more administrative skills.
Hmm. Well, there certainly, and we're coming down to the point here, we just have a couple of minutes left, but certainly it is true that there are a number of countries in the region that would be interested in having a stable Pakistan. At the same time, so we're talking stable Afghanistan, and we're talking about Pakistan, Russia, China, Iran, and India, and certainly the United States, not being in the region, but certainly the United States. And again, though, the problem here is that they all have their particular agendas, and is it possible for them to set those aside somewhat, or at least put them on the back burner, and to think about what might actually be done, how they could all work together, or at least work towards the same goal, and that goal being a stable Afghanistan?
There is, and there is a precedent for this, David. In the late 19th century, the British Empire and the Russian Empire decided not to continue to fight over Afghanistan, and they created this idea of the Afghan buffer, a neutral Afghanistan where neither one would seek to dominate Afghanistan. They did that because of the rising power of Germany in Central Europe and both the Russians and the British needed to focus on that threat and not go at each other in Central Asia. So that buffer zone role of Afghanistan continued right up until about 1982, right up to 1978, the communist coup and the Soviet invasion, when the Soviets broke the buffer. Now we have to return to that, where outside powers do exercise mutual restraint. The biggest obstacle to that is the Pakistani military and its ISI arm, because they've invested so much in this jihadi infrastructure, which has defensive and offensive qualities to it and actually threatens our national interests. And if the United States and the international community can encourage Pakistan to change its policy to cooperate with us in stamping out terrorism inside Pakistan as well as elsewhere, then we can go back to this course. And the road ahead would be an international conference, which I describe in the book, like the Congress of Vienna, which played a role in neutralizing Belgium. Austria was a neutral country as a result of an agreement between the United States and its Western European allies and Soviet Union during the Cold War, where it became a neutral country in Central Europe for the duration of the Cold War. So there are precedents to do something like this, but you need to see a fundamental change in Pakistan's policy first. Hmm.
Well, there we will have to leave it. There is a broad story told here worth spending more time than we have right at this moment. And for people who would like to read more about the history of Afghanistan, the book is The Wars of Afghanistan, published by Public Affairs, by our guest Peter Thompson. And again, if you go looking for the book, his name is spelled T-O-M-S-E-N. Peter Thompson is ambassador in residence at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and was the special envoy of the U.S., to Afghanistan. This was during the time of the first President Bush. He had the rank of ambassador. This was in the late 80s and early 90s. And Ambassador Thompson, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure, David.